Saving money on your next project now at Menards. Menards is the leading supplier of quality roof and floor trusses. Choose from our large selection of residential and post-frame trusses or design custom trusses specifically for your project. Get started on your building project today, in-store or on Menards.com. Plus, view our weekly flyer for all the great deals happening now. Saving money on your next project now at Menards. Menards is the leading supplier of quality roof and floor trusses. Choose from our large selection of residential and post-frame trusses or design custom trusses specifically for your project. Get started on your building project today, in-store or on Menards.com. Plus, view our weekly flyer for all the great deals happening now. Save big money
at Menards. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
Nolan Wells' phone came home on July 4th. His car keys came home on July 4th. Nolan Wells did not come home on July 4th. An 18-year-old college football player was left on an uninhabited barrier island 10 miles off the Mississippi coast. No phone, no keys, no way to call for help, no way to drive home, even if somehow he made it back to shore. And the friends who had his phone and his keys in their possession didn't tell his family. Is there an innocent explanation for this? I don't know. And that's where we sit. His mother, Christine Wansley, had to track that phone down herself. Nobody volunteered it. Self-indulged teens focusing on themselves and no one else. Not an entirely far-fetched idea that they're unaware of this little factoid. If they're thinking that their friend is going to come back and somehow get over and pick up his phone and keys, that might be the thought process. I don't know. But it is a question worth asking and looking into a bit. There may be an innocent explanation. There may not be. We don't know the answer to that. That phone is key to this case. That phone is now headed for a joint forensic inspection. Ben Crump's team and Jackson County DA Angel Myers' office agreed to examine it together. The FBI is assisting with digital evidence, and when forensic examiners open that device, they won't just see what's on the screen. They'll see what was removed from the screen, if anything. They'll see what was never on the screen in the first place, too. And the difference between those two things is the difference between a cover-up and a tragedy. We're going to work through this about the phone, because the phone, at the end of the day, just look, speaking from experience of covering hundreds of cases, phones end up being like almost the end all be all in so many things, in so many cases. They tell us so much. In my opinion, they tell us more than DNA sometimes. They tell us more than eyewitness accounts. They tell us sometimes what people are thinking in their minds, because that's how they search. That's what they look up. That's what they type. And sometimes they leave us with big empty voids. Or maybe there should be information. One would expect there to be information because of how this young man allegedly used his phone regularly. But then there's times, odd times in life, where you set your phone down. I know, what a concept. But we do sometimes, and one of those times does tend to happen to be statistically on a boat. When you're going to go in the water and hang out with your friends, a lot of times people put their phone in the boat and they don't touch it for a while. And it looks like a void. If he came back fine and somebody's looking at his Snapchat going, what the hell? There's no snaps here. What was going on? Oh, I was in the water with the friends. Oh, okay. That's the end of that conversation. But when you're missing and you come washed up on shore, deceased, that void holds a lot of questions and not a lot of answers. But again, that's what digital forensics will tell us. If there was, in fact, deleted Snapchat posts, if there was, in fact, items on that phone that are no longer there. Digital forensics will answer that question. That will not be up for dispute. What the ether does with that information, well, that's going to be an interesting thing to watch. Because we just don't know where it goes, but where it goes is where it goes. There's also a disputed video that was supposed to settle whether Nolan was arguing about his phone on Horn Island before he disappeared. It didn't really settle anything. It actually made the picture worse. But first, you need to understand who Nolan Wells was the night before everything changed. On July 3rd, Nolan allegedly cooked his parents baked salmon for dinner because his mom had a busy day at work. Lovely. That's the kind of kid he was. 18 years old, a student athlete at Southwest Mississippi Community College, and his instinct after a long day was to cook for his mother. The next morning, he slept over at a friend's house, went to Horn Island for the 4th of July, and never came home. That salmon dinner was the last normal thing Christine Wansley, his mother, experienced with her son. Now, here's some matters about the phone and why. All right. The sheriff said on July 6th that no foul play had been identified. The investigators had interviewed approximately 60 witnesses. According to the Sun-Herald, the FBI is examining digital evidence. The DA has committed to presenting the case to a grand jury once the investigation is complete. And the digital evidence from that phone may be the single most concrete body of evidence the grand jury sees. That's how much weight this single device carries. That phone made six stops between Nolan's hand and the forensic lab. Every one of them is a decision somebody made. The phone starts with Nolan on Horn Island. He traveled there by boat with three friends, including Warren Hudson, the stepson of Jackson County Judge Ashley Cole. And according to multiple reports, roughly 200 people were partying on the island that day. Nolan was last seen at approximately 3 p.m. on July 4th. According to Crump, the sheriff, and Judge Cole's own Facebook statement. Now, I want to be very clear. I am not accusing anyone of doing anything criminal, harmful, in any way, shape, or form in this. So do not go down that road with me. I'm saying we don't know. We do not know what happened. I would say, as I've said in other statements, in other monologues, there isn't a lot of evidence that points to there being anything of that nature that happened here. There is conflicting stories on what he told people. That seems to be a little more easily explainable, again, my conjecture, than suddenly his close friends that he's been friends with forever suddenly turned on him because of his skin color and decided to murder him at sea. Seems a little out of character from everything we know about these friends and everything that's come out. And with that many people, if there was something like that that happened publicly in front of people, I think I would venture to guess it may have come out by now. But did something else happen? Did something happen where other people didn't see? Were other people involved? Maybe a few saw something, or maybe no one saw anything, and that's what makes this case so perplexing, that the sea stole Nolan through a riptide and carried him out and no one noticed. Not an impossibility. In fact, an all too real possibility on that very specific island, or really anywhere in the ocean. Hundreds of deaths every single year because of riptides and people suddenly gone. But again, we just don't know right now. Nolan was last seen at approximately 3 p.m. on July 4th, according to Crump, the sheriff, and Judge Cole's own Facebook statement. At some point between arriving on the island at 3 p.m., that phone left Nolan's possession. How it happened is disputed. Crump's team obtained video that they initially said showed Nolan demanding his phone back from someone on the island. And according to Crump, Nolan can be heard saying words to the effect of, "Give me my phone, what are you doing?" And then his actual friends came out, the ones that actually know him that didn't show up for profit. Tristan Shepard disputes that. Shepard, a high school friend of Nolan's who was on Horn Island that day, told ABC News and Rolling Stone that the voice in the video is his own, not Nolan's, not Crump's assertion. Shepard said the confrontation had nothing to do with the phone and that Nolan doesn't appear in the footage at all. The Wells family, through Crump, said they cannot discount Shepherd's account, but emphasized the investigation is ongoing. So the piece of evidence that was supposed to explain how the phone itself changed hands is now a very contested piece of evidence. And look, the video itself, if we can get to the core of it, will really answer that question. It's called metadata. It'll show you where that video was. And it can also then, if other videos were taken around that same time with those same people, you'll be able to compare clothing. You'll be able to, it will be either confirmed or debunked. We are sitting in the middle of we don't know right now. You have Crump making a ton of statements that are opinion being presented as fact, or assertions being presented as fact. And the general public either going, must be true, or us going, well, okay, that's what you're telling us. Let's run the evidence and figure out if what you're saying is in fact true and factual, because there's ways of doing it. I don't just have to take your word for it. No one does. I mean, that's why you have an investigation. And not just vitriol. Because if nothing happened to Nolan Wells by his friends, do you think he's sitting somewhere on the other side going, oh, this is great? This is lovely. All my friends that I do love and love me, and something accidental happened, now they're all being targeted by people who think they had some sort of racial hatred towards me, when in fact that's not remotely the truth at all. Or if something did happen, yeah, I'm sure he'd want justice. The thing is, we don't know the answer to that question. And the questions need to be asked, especially considering the place of the country where this took place. I'm saying you need to understand the motivations on both sides. But at the same point, when facts rise that are not disputable because they're not opinions, you have to let them lie where they lie. The friends leave the boat by around 4:30 p.m. The bilge pump fails. They call emergency services for a tow. The dispatcher asks if everybody aboard is safe. The response captured the audio obtained by NBC News. Yeah, everybody's on board. Nolan's phone is on that boat. Nolan is not. GPS data from the Mississippi Department of Marine Resources obtained by CBS News shows the boat departed Horn Island at approximately 4:31 p.m. The boat was eventually towed and made it back to the mainland. Seven people were reportedly on board, according to the audio. The friends reached the mainland with Nolan's phone and his car keys. They did not contact his family, not at 5 o'clock, not at 6, not at 7, 8, 9, or 10. When Nolan's friend finally calls Christine Wansley at approximately 11, that's roughly 7 hours after they left the island without her son. 7 hours where an 18-year-old was alone on a barrier island with no communication, no transportation, and no way to get himself home. And the people who had his belongings said nothing. Again, perspective is key on this. You have friends who, if their story is true, if they believed Nolan was going to stay on the island to talk to the girl, or for whatever reason, he's staying back on the island, and they have his keys and they have his phone, well, they know he can't communicate directly with them, so they're going to hold on to them. And he's an adult. They don't necessarily have to call mom and say, hey, here's his keys and here's his phone. They may be waiting for their adult friend to make it back to pick up his stuff. Not crazy. They may even want to do that. Like, oh, I got your phone. I got your stuff. I don't want to worry your mom. All really... If that's your mindset of what your friend did, going, shit, he forgot his phone. Well, I got it, got his keys, you know. They didn't even know where his keys were. They were left on the Xbox at the house. They weren't on the boat even. I don't know. It doesn't sound completely implausible. It doesn't even sound not plausible. It sounds fairly likely if this is the mindset that you're in, these are probably the actions you would take. If they had chucked his phone into the ocean, that would be a bit more suspicious. If they had his phone and hid it and refused to return it, that would be suspicious. If things are actually deleted off of his phone and not just conjecture of things are deleted because there's nothing there, which does seem to have a fairly plausible explanation of they were in the water and left the phone on the boat, all of it does seem very plausible. It doesn't seem like some strange outlier, like all these things have to work out for this to be true. No, it seems like what would happen if everyone's operating from the mindset of Nolan went off and met a girl and he's coming back to get his stuff later. It doesn't necessarily read of we killed our friend and we're, you know, disposing of the evidence. I don't know. That, but again, questions should be asked, investigations need to be done, and the actual information on the phone will tell us a lot. The actual information on the phone will tell us a lot. Not an attorney, not somebody attaching themselves to this case for their own political purposes or attention-seeking or money-grubbing behavior. The actual phone, his actual actions with that phone will tell us a lot. We just don't know the answer to that yet. Christine Wansley is the one who finds the phone. She tracks it down from the friends. According to her account to Good Morning America, the friends never volunteered that they had it. Is that suspicious? That's what an attorney wants the world to believe, but is it truly suspicious? I don't know. Seen a lot of people with suspicious things in phones, and other than an assertion that Snapchat was empty, I'm not seeing a whole lot of suspicious stuff here. But again, maybe there's more to come out. Maybe we'll get some more information, and we'll follow it. When she opened the device, Snapchat messages from July 4th said it was empty. Empty and missing are two different things, but the operative word that keeps being used from the Crump camp is missing. But is that true? Missing and empty, missing, not ever used, two different things. Her son used Snapchat frequently, and there should have been activity. Again, a should doesn't always mean is. There reportedly wasn't. She also said the device's location history didn't match some of the accounts the friends had given investigators. And that's as loose of a statement as you have. There's no specificity as to what exactly that means, other than what we know about he was going to hang out with the girl, and the girl said he was going to go on the boat. Why the conflicting stories? I don't know. The phone is now the pipeline for joint forensic examination. Crump and DA McGrath agreed to what Crump called a mutual inspection on July 15th. The FBI is involved in analyzing the digital evidence, and that inspection is going to answer questions that no witness interview, no press conference, and no social media theory can touch. People need to understand something about digital forensics. Everyone is asking whether messages were deleted from Nolan's phone. That's the wrong question. The right question is whether messages were deleted or whether they were never there in the first place, because those are two completely different things, and a forensic examiner can tell the difference. When someone deletes a Snapchat message from a phone, the app removes a visible pathway to the file. The message disappears from the screen, but the data doesn't evaporate. It sits in cached databases on the phone's local storage. Forensic tools can dig through those layers and recover fragments of messages, timestamps, and metadata that the person who deleted them thought were gone. Snapchat's own servers retain unopened messages for up to 30 days. Viewed messages are typically removed within 24 hours, but cached copies often remain on the device itself in what's called an unallocated disk space. But if a message was never sent, if Nolan simply wasn't using his phone that afternoon because he was swimming, socializing, doing what 18-year-olds do at a 4th of July beach party, then there's nothing to recover. No ghost data, no hidden fragments, just an empty timeline that reflects a kid who put his phone down and went to have fun. The absence of Snapchat activity in that scenario isn't suspicious. It's a teenager at a party. Again, we don't know. A forensic examiner can distinguish, though, between these two scenarios at a data level, and it couldn't come quicker. A deleted message leaves a specific kind of footprint. It's a gap in the database where an entry was removed. There's a timestamp that matches. They're cached files that no longer have a corresponding visible record. A message that was never sent leaves no footprint at all. The database just shows an activity, clean activity. The difference between somebody cleaned this up and nothing happened here is visible to anyone with the right tools and the right training. Snapchat's own auto-delete functionality complicates this further. The app is designed to erase content on a schedule. Viewed snaps disappear, chat logs clear, stories expire after 24 hours. If Nolan's phone sat untouched from the afternoon of July 4th until his mother retrieved it later, the app's normal housekeeping functions would have purged content automatically, not because someone tampered with it, because the app did what the app did. But the claim is she got it within the 24-hour period and it was empty. All right, we'll bring in the forensic examination of the phone. So the forensic examination will answer one of three things. One, messages were actively deleted by a human hand, and the digital fingerprints of the deletion are still embedded in the device. Or two, messages were never sent because the phone wasn't being used, and the data shows clean activity consistent with the device that was sitting idle. Or three, Snapchat's auto-delete functions remove content on schedule, and the pattern matches the app's normal behavior rather than a selective manual deletion. Each of those outcomes tells a different story, and each one is provable. It does get a little more complex, though, if someone deleted it, because the phone ain't necessarily going to tell you who did that. So one of those outcomes would clear the friends of deleting Snapchat messages, which seems to be a big piece of fruit here on the vine that a lot of people are eating and attaching their boat to, no pun intended, of the friends did this. Well, if it turns out they didn't, then what? What else is there? It's a big piece. If the forensic inspection shows that Nolan's phone was on the boat the entire time, that never separated from the group's devices, the most likely explanation is the simplest one. Nolan left his phone on the boat before he went swimming or walking or talking to people on the island. He didn't have it on him because he didn't need it. 200 people, a beach, 4th of July. Leaving your phone on a boat while you go hang out is not suspicious behavior. It's very normal behavior, actually. If the Snapchat data shows no activity from Nolan's account after a certain point in the early afternoon, not deleted activity, but simply no activity, then the phone was idle because its owner wasn't using it. If the location data on the phone matches the friend's timeline, island, boat, mainland, consistent at the 4:30 p.m. departure and the bilge pump distress call at 4 o'clock, then the phone corroborates their account. That's not the version of events that satisfies anyone. It doesn't give the family answers about what happened to their son on the island. It doesn't explain why the friends waited 7 hours to call. It doesn't explain why they never volunteered that they had his phone and keys. But the data says it. The data says it. If the data says it. And the family deserves whichever answer is true, not the answer the internet wants. The answer the phone actually recorded. They deserve the truth. But Nolan's phone is not the only device that matters, and this is where the case either locks into place or falls apart. Every person on that boat had a phone. Every one of those phones was pinging cell towers, logging GPS coordinates, and recording app activity in the background. Cell carriers retain tower ping data. That data shows not just location, but movement, whether a phone was stationary or in transit, in which direction it was traveling. When investigators overlay the location data from Nolan's phone against the data from the friend's phone, the timelines either match or they don't. If all four phones are in the same location at the same time until three, and then three phones move to the boat, while one stays on the island, the phone that stayed behind was with Nolan. That changes the story. If all four phones move together, island to boat to mainland, with no separation at any point, then Nolan's phone was always with the group, and he wasn't carrying it. Trial attorney Dante Mills told News Nation that electronic evidence is functionally tamper-proof, timestamps, location data, message logs are embedded at a system level that he described as really difficult to change. Retired FBI agent Kieran Ramsey backed that up. He told the same outlet that investigators can recover several layers of data, even from devices where content was deliberately removed. The friends' phones also contain their own records, their own text messages, call logs, Snapchat data, cross-referencing who contacted whom and when tells its own story. If the friends were texting each other between 4:30 and 11 p.m., coordinating, discussing, deciding what to say before they called Christine, that shows up. If a group chat went silent at a suspicious hour, that shows up too. And if the friends' phones show them arriving home in the late afternoon but not reaching out to anyone about Nolan until almost midnight, those seven quiet hours have their own data trail. But again, that's all conjecture. That ain't fact. That ain't even an accusation. That's just a big what if. The question is not just why they waited. The question is what their phones show them doing while they waited. And the disputed video is not the only footage from that day. Crump's independent investigators are reportedly receiving 50 to 100 calls per day from people who were on Horn Island on July 4th. Some of those people have their own videos, their own photos, their own phones, and their own location data, and their own timestamps. The phone is the headline witness. It's not the only witness. Every one of those data points either builds the same picture or contradicts it. Cell tower records from the carrier, GPS logs from the phone's operating system, app-level location data from Snapchat, and every other app that was running in the background. The timestamps on every message sent and received, cache files in the phone's local storage, server-side records from Snapchat's own systems, preserved under a legal hold if investigators issued one in time. Each layer is independent of the others. Each layer is nearly impossible to alter without leaving a trace. And each layer either confirms the friend's account or it doesn't. Al Sharpton and Tyler Perry announced a combined $100,000 reward at Nolan's funeral for information leading to an arrest. Spike Lee and Terrell Owens were in attendance. The national attention on the case is enormous, but attention is not evidence. Press conferences are not evidence. Rewards are not evidence. That phone is evidence. And it's about to speak. Nolan Wells was 18 years old. He was a football player, a business major. And the kind of kid his coaches described as happy-go-lucky with a brilliant smile. The night before he disappeared, he cooked his parents salmon because his mother had a long day. He went to an island with friends he'd known since high school, and he never came home. His phone came home without him. His keys came home without him. And for 7 hours, nobody told his mother. That phone has been in more hands than it should have been. It's about to be in the right ones. And whatever it says, whether it reveals something or devastating or confirms something ordinary, it's the closest thing this family has to a witness who cannot change their story. Your thoughts in the comments section on Substack and YouTube. We will continue our conversation right there. Until next time, be sure to press subscribe. My name's Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.